Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There's a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success. Welcome back to Entrepreneur Architect, the podcast where architects are inspired to build better businesses. I am your host, Mark R. LePage, and this is episode 12. Rena Klein is a teacher, a speaker, an author, and principal of R.M. Klein Consulting, a firm offering a variety of services aimed at small firm architects. Today on the Entrepreneur Architect Podcast, Rena and I discuss how business consultants may help you build a better business. We talk about everything from the AIA focusing on small firm architects, marketing, work-life balance, ownership transitions, firm valuations, and so much more. So go grab your Moleskin or open your Evernote, because this is going to be an episode that you want to take notes on. And be sure to listen all the way to the end, because Rena shares some exclusive inside information about the recently published 15th edition of the Architect's Handbook for Professional Practice, of which she is the AIA executive editor. So as I say to my kids, go get your listening ears on. This is an information-packed episode. I hope you like it. Here's the interview. So Rena Klein, thank you very much for joining me on the Entrepreneur Architect Podcast.
You're welcome. Nice to be here.
I always like to kind of start with my guest's backstory. Could you kind of tell us sort of the point where you decided that you wanted to become an architect, and then kind of give us the story from that point to where you are today and what you're doing today?
Okay. I decided I wanted to be an architect in high school. I was lucky enough to have a teacher who recognized that my abilities, good in science, good in art, and that architecture might be a good thing for me, which was very forward thinking, since girls weren't always encouraged to go into fields like this. But I was, and I did, and I started my architectural education at Carnegie Mellon University in the late 60s, early 70s. And then I transferred to the University of Oregon, and I finished my work there, which is what had brought me to the Pacific Northwest. So I had got my Bachelor in Architecture 5-year program from University of Oregon. And I stayed in Eugene, Oregon for quite a while, and eventually made my way to Seattle, where I finished my internship and got my architectural license in Washington State. I started my own firm shortly thereafter, and had my own firm in Seattle for about 20 years. We specialized in residences, new houses, lots of remodels. At its largest, it was about 5 people. But after about 10 or 12 years in business, I became sort of dissatisfied, and I noticed the kind of widespread disillusionment among my small firm colleagues, although everybody was very dedicated and into what they were doing in general, but a sense that, you know, working too hard, having too much stress, not making enough money, all these kinds of issues, and in my own firm as well. I mean, there were years when I was paying my staff more than I was making. And, you know, after doing that for a while, you begin to question what you're doing. So I decided to go back to school. I went to Antioch University and enrolled in a graduate program in management and organizational development, mostly to understand how I could improve my firm. But while I was in school, I discovered, you know, I guess I was kind of naive, but I discovered there was this whole discipline of management and even more importantly, of organizational design. And I learned that I could apply design thinking to how organizations or architectural firms were run. And this was a great revelation to me. So after I graduated, I decided I wanted to share my newfound knowledge, because I knew quite well that most entrepreneurial architects like myself had very little education in business processes and in management. So I made it my mission to start trying to educate my colleagues. And I started doing workshops at AIA conventions and teaching through the university students professional practice. I had more and more opportunities like this coming my way. So I began to transition my work from just doing architectural projects to also teaching and consulting with my colleagues about how to help them run their firms better and have less stress, make more money, you know, have more fun in their practice in general. So that brought me to this transition state, and eventually I got a position teaching at Washington State University and basically downsized and closed my practice, even though I do still do a project now and then for old clients. So I started teaching at Washington State, and then I got an opportunity to work for AIA as the executive editor of the Architect's Handbook of Professional Practice, which was a two-year contract, and it's the 15th edition of that that text, which is due out actually next month in November 2013. That'll be on the shelves, and is a real departure from some of the past versions of the Architect's Handbook of Professional Practice, particularly in that it focuses on small. There's a lot of information about small firm practice.
That's very exciting to hear that.
I also wrote a book on small firm practice called the Architect's Guide to Small Firm Management, sort of bringing together all the knowledge that I'd gained through my consulting practice and studies in the last 10 years or so. So now I work pretty much full time as a consultant to other small architectural firms, and I've also continued my volunteer work at AIA, because I'm the, in 2014, I'll become the chair of the Practice Management Knowledge Community. So I have my pulse on a lot of different arenas of practice management, but particularly in the small firm realm.
Yeah, that's very interesting. We have very similar missions. You know, that's certainly what Entrepreneur Architect is all about, is teaching small firms and sole proprietors about business. I have a similar story, and I think we both have the same goal, is to try to help the profession become stronger by teaching architects how to run better businesses.
Exactly.
And I love that you're involved in AIA and having influence there for small firms, because that's, you know, very needed. Mm-hmm. And I think that small firm architects really don't see much value, and that's sort of a generalization, but many small architects and sole proprietors see the AIA as a, you know, big firm organization, that they don't see that there's value as being a member. And I don't necessarily agree with that, but I know that there are many architects that feel that way. And so it's nice to hear that they're putting some significant investment into small firms.
Yeah, I do believe that they are. You know, I think that was one of the reasons that I was hired to be the executive editor of the handbook, because they wanted that influence, and they certainly got it. And then also, you know, the AIA now has a small firm roundtable, which is working on various initiatives that are directly targeted towards small firms, which, of course, as you know, are more than 90% of AIA firms.
Right.
Right.
So let's talk a little bit about your consulting work and how that works, and what do you do? What are the benefits of a small firm working with you?
Well, I think that as we both know and as discussed before, small firm leaders often have difficulty getting access to information about how to run their firms better, about management, about business processes, and I think that my work and consultants in general can kind of break through a sense of isolation that sometimes small firm owners experience. Though it's better now, like through sites like yours, but that they tend to kind of reinvent the wheel, you know, make it up as they go along, and often they do really well with that, you know, getting very close to, you know, what might be called standard business practices, but without, right, in general, without much education in that, you know, it might be kind of a little bit off base. So I often help people improve their business and management practices so that it reflects more of the best practices in our industry, especially for small firms. And one of the things that consultants can bring to small firms is kind of a broad experience, seeing how many small firms do things, and kind of culling out the best practices and then communicating that to their clients. Also, consultants sometimes have education in the various business specialties that or specialized functions that we have to deal with, like finance or marketing or operations. And sometimes that, you know, advanced knowledge, I mean, after all, it can really be helpful. I mean, after all, architects want to do architecture, and they want to get advanced knowledge in design and building technologies and the things they need to be better architects. They don't often want to spend energy getting more advanced knowledge on, you know, finance or accounting, and yet they or even marketing. Yet they need that information in order to be successful often in their businesses. And the other thing that consultants bring is kind of an in-touchness with trends in the industry. And help their clients maybe be a little bit more expansive in their thinking about what might be possible for their firm. Of course, take into account their talents, interests, the market opportunities they have, and so forth.
Right. How much time do you think an architect, say a small firm architect, you know, maybe a couple of employees who's running a firm, how much time do you think, maybe on a weekly basis, they should be dedicating to management and development of their business, separate from their architecture?
Well, you know, again, it depends. I mean, I think that most firm principals of small architectural firms will spend at least half their time, maybe more, in you know, non-billable work, which includes, you know, proposals and meeting people, as well as the business processes. You know, I often advise firm leaders to spend a minimum of about 4 hours a week dedicated to marketing and business development, and that can be in a lot of different realms. But if we're talking about all the business processes, you know, I think, you know, depending on the firm, I think that's going to take at least 8 to 10 hours a week of a you know, a firm leader's time. You know, a sole proprietor, of course, it would be less, but to really organize the work that needs to be done, and to be able to think strategically about the future. You know, one of the things that I've observed is that many small firm leaders are kind of often running from, you know, one deadline to the next. And it's really difficult to carve out time for strategic thinking. So sometimes having a consultant involved can help a small firm owner just say, okay, I have to take out this time in order to strategically think about where I want to go. Because at some point, most firms have to transfer from being opportunistic, which is really understandable at startup, to being more strategic, to taking jobs and to acquiring, to developing their firm in a way that is really reflective of what a firm leader is really interested in, really talented at, really wants as a purpose for their firm. And for some people, that will very well include work-life balance. So how can you shape a firm in a way that reflects what you want in your lifestyle? And I often say to my clients and in my classes, you know, what's the point of having your own firm if you can't organize it in a way that, like, provides you a satisfying life as well as, you know, perhaps reasonable compensation? So so I think consultants can help in that. You know, I think a lot of times in small firms, consultants can act as a trusted advisor, you know, a knowledgeable coach that somebody can just access to help them figure out some of the business dilemmas that they might encounter. And I do that a lot, sort of on phone consultation, you know, on an hourly basis, just to help talk over, you know, current business issues that a small firm owner might be facing. Although that often leads to maybe a need for some kind of an assessment process where I can become more familiar with their financial situation, their market position, and things like that, which will help me be a better advisor. And I usually do that on a fee basis, and often that's just, you know, under a few thousand dollars to get enough familiarity and assessment so that I can really be helpful and a effective coach to a firm leader.
Right. I wanted to ask you about pricing, because I think a lot of architects will listen to us and hear the value and the benefits of having a coach or a consultant, but be afraid that they just can't afford it. Is there sort of, again, for that small firm with a couple of employees, sort of a range of maybe annual budgeting number that they could use, that they could get started and get kind of on the right track, and then as things grow and improve, you know, then they can invest more time and more money? Is there sort of a minimum, you know, opportunity to get in?
Yeah. Well, like I said, I often will do, you know, just an on-call consultation, a one-off kind of thing, or something once a month for people. And my basic rate is $150 an hour, but I can't really speak to other consultants about what they charge. But, you know, in this market, I think if you're a consultant working in a small firm market, it's unlikely that you're going to, you know, get $400 an hour that consultants charge in you know, a large firm context. And I wouldn't, it's just not, it doesn't seem to really make sense in the market of small firm leaders. However, I think that talking about $500 or $600 a month um, for 3 or 4 hours of consulting is probably something most firms could afford and could budget into their annual budget. And so that might be, you know, in the neighborhood of $6,000 a year or something like that, $500 a month. But it could be far less than that. Of course, it could be more than that if you want to engage in a full strategic planning process, which involves assessment of the firm, and an assessment not just financially, but also probably how the staff is feeling, engaging the staff in this process. You know, staff morale, operations, marketing, competitive. Marketplace, that kind of thing, positioning, all those kinds of things, an assessment, and then a planning process, which involves, you know, actually the strategic planning, where do you want to be, you know, how to get there, and then an implementation phase, which usually involves some ongoing coaching. So it kind of tracks building design. It's sort of like assessment is the programming part. The planning is schematic design, and we do some scenario planning, looking at different options. And then the implementation is sort of like construction documents or construction with action plans that, you know, will get you there, which includes often a growth plan or a marketing plan. You know, that kind of engagement could be anywhere from, you know, $8,000 to $20,000, depending on the size of the firm and the depth and ongoingness of the engagement. But at the same time, you know, for a few thousand dollars, firms can get an assessment, sort of have a good sense of where they are in relation to industry benchmarks, which is something that firms come to me a lot for. You know, where are we? You know, we are doing this, but how we're confused about the benchmarks and what's going on. And then an ongoing coaching thing. And I also discount, I give a little less, I charge a little less for like one person startups. People are just getting started and they just really need a few hours of advice. I'll do that for $125. And I also charge less to nonprofits. I work with a community design center, which is a nonprofit, and I, you know, have a bit of a sliding scale in that kind of market as well.
Right. I think that's very helpful to for architects to kind of know what's available and get a sense of, you know, how much it would cost.
As I said, I can't say much about other, just like architects, you know, consultants don't talk to each other much about what they charge.
Much like architects.
Right. So I'm just speaking for me, but you know, for your listeners, that's where.
Right. Well, much like architects not really knowing how much to charge for their own services, because architects are so tight-lipped on what they charge and how they charge. That's one of the things that I tend to try to provoke is to have those conversations among architects about money and fees, so they can learn from one another and on what's appropriate and how, you know, how different structures work and generally, you know, how much different services should cost.
What I use as basically a rule of thumb is that I try to charge the same as the principal's billing rate. Mm-hmm. it seems only fair, you know. And also to that's reasonable within the kind of market that we're working within.
I think that's a good idea. A good idea of how much services like that would cost. Are there specific maybe one or two areas of firms, small firms, that you find are the most lacking when you go in and you do that initial analysis of the firm? Are there specific things that are happening in patterns in most firms that should be addressed right away?
Well, let's put it this way. Often I'm brought in to the firm with the notion on the part of the leadership that they want to do some kind of strategic planning process, that they want to do some growth planning, or they want to rebuild after the downsizing of the recession, and they want some ideas about how that will happen. But sometimes when I begin that process, I discover that there are more pressing issues on an operational in an operational way, that there's a lot of inefficiencies and wasting time and unnecessarily redos and bad time management or bad communication aspects. And often I come in with very simple suggestions, like the principal should make daily rounds and talk to each one of the project architects, virtually every day to kind of stop the communication misunderstandings that can happen when people only text one another.
Right.
And the principal is out of the office most of the time and comes back in 3 days later and says, "Oh no, you put the addition on the wrong side of the house."
Yeah.
There's those kinds of communication issues. Sometimes there's some time management stuff that we can just put in some simple operational ideas that can improve things right away. Like, what I preach a lot: routinize the routine, identify the routine parts of our work and make that very routine, and then you have more time to do the non-routine parts like design and business development. So sometimes, they want to start with strategic planning, but they just don't even have time to engage in it because their operational aspects are a mess, or their some aspects of the business processes are really cumbersome and are just taking so much more time than necessary, double entry and bookkeeping and various things, opportunities for mistakes. So sometimes I'll go in and say, okay, first we have to look at some operational issues and try to improve things, the low-hanging fruit, and then we'll have time to begin to talk about strategy for the future. And then another thing I sometimes see is principals overworking, principals who are doing, 60 or 70 hours a week, and that's an operational issue also. Or finance, looking at finance over time, and you discuss that, and you notice that, maybe more and more gross revenue is coming in, but the profit line stays flat. That's also an indication of operational problems. So sometimes through the assessment process, we identify things or staff morale. Sometimes people are very unhappy, and when people aren't happy, they don't work as well. I mean, there's a reinforcing relationship between staff satisfaction and productivity. So sometimes you have to look at that, and that's sort of sometimes tricky, because often it has to do with ways that the principal might be acting.
Right, right, yeah.
So then I kind of have to be a bit of an organizational psychologist.
Yeah.
Have some serious conversations with the principal, and, sometimes they want to change, sometimes they don't.
Yeah.
We go from there.
Right, so it sounds like a lot of initial work is sort of fixing those procedures that are put in place because of what you talked about in the beginning, where architects sort of make it up along the way and, get close to where they should be from a business point of view just out of necessity, but never were really taught what they needed to know to have the right structures and the right framework in place to have an efficient business. And you can kind of go in there and move things around and fix things in order to kind of put them in the right places in order for them to get to the next step of business development.
That's right. That's exactly right. I mean, it's often very easy to do, but certain ways of doing things get institutionalized.
Right.
And one of the other benefits of having a consultant come in is that you really get an outside point of view on what you're doing, and somebody that can tell you and that's true not only of, various business processes, but it's also true of your marketing material. I've come into firms where they have a website and various marketing materials, and just are, they're too close to it.
Right.
You know, they're completely unaware of the actual message that they're sending out to the world. And so, you know, sometimes just an outside pair of eyes who's willing to be honest can say, you know, look, it's not surprising that you're not attracting the kinds of clients that you want because this and this.
Right. I mean, very often marketing material, websites and brochures are really just, you know, picture books of the projects they're most proud of, and they're not really focused on the target market that they're trying to reach. And, you know, it's not saying the things that need to be said that the architect doesn't really care about because they just want to show their beautiful architecture. But in order to get to where they want to go, it needs to actually be specific and intentional.
Exactly. And of course, that's a big part of a strategic planning process that eventually works its way into a marketing plan and, you know, a very focused approach towards acquiring projects.
Yeah. What about, I've had several architects contact me about ownership transition, you know, from both sides, from architects who are getting ready to kind of slow things down but don't want to close the shop, or younger architects who are coming in and have an opportunity to take over a firm but have no idea how to do that. Is that something a consultant could help as well?
Absolutely. I'm really glad that you brought that up because right now, you know, with baby boomers retiring and generational demographics as they are, there's a lot of this kind of thing going on. Yeah. And I do help firms with that. It depends on the situation. Sometimes I help a group of, you know, senior people in the firm who are going to become the owners when the founders retire, and I help them form partnership agreements between themselves, as well as respond to an offer or make an offer. And then sometimes on the other side, I help the retiring principals formulate an offer or even figure out whether it's worth it to them to sell the firm. You know, and sometimes it's not, you know, because they're very lucrative and they can do just as well kind of slowly ramping it down. It really depends on the personalities involved, you know, and then there's firm valuation, which I can help with on a very general basis, you know, using rule of thumbs. I'm not an accountant, but I do understand, you know, the basics of how firms are valued. Of course, you know, people in this situation should go to an accountant they trust, you know, agree on a valuation of the firm as sort of the first step. Sometimes that's the hardest step. But I often act as kind of almost a mediator, you know, someone to help close the deal.
Right.
and bring the two parties together, but also with this understanding that there needs to be, besides the financial agreement, there needs to be agreements that relate to roles and responsibilities and shifting of authority, decision-making power about certain things. You know, sometimes, especially when it's done incrementally, you bring in partners that have, you know, 20% or 30% and more as time passes by. Well, does that mean that 20% or 30% of the power decision making or job acquisition goes to those partners? You know, all that needs to be discussed.
Right, right. That and you kind of become the marriage counselor.
In a way, yes.
So you kind of work on both from both sides in that situation. You're sort of in the middle between the two of them. Just, you know, where the firm owner and the new architect that will be taking over sort of already agreed that this is what they want to do, but they don't really know how to get there. You can help them get there.
I can. But again, I want to emphasize, not an accountant,
yeah,
not an attorney. And so it's more in the realm of, you know, an operational agreement,
right,
you might say. And then the lawyer can come in and make it, you know,
right,
a legal document.
And I know you're not an accountant, but can you give listeners sort of just a general idea of how most firms are valued? How do they come up with the valuation of a firm?
Well, it depends on whether it's an external sale or an internal sale. Mm-hmm. And generally speaking, it starts with book value, which is kind of the value of the hard assets, like the computers and the stuff,
right,
as well as sometimes I think often accounts receivable backlog is counted in those hard assets that are backlog may be a little less percentage, but you know, if you have a bunch of receivables, that's real money that's gonna come into the firm. So you have the book value of the firm, and then it's often that's for an internal sale. You'll see 1x book value or even less. Sometimes it's discounted because the people who are buying in basically can't afford it,
right,
or have to buy in slowly over time based on, you know, maybe they don't get bonuses and they gain equity through that, or their salary isn't increased and they get equity based on the amount that their salary would have been increased. That kind of thing can make it work, or a balloon payment later on. With external sales, depending on, it's unusual for, in a merger or acquisition kind of thing with a bigger firm taking over a smaller firm that maybe has a niche in a locale or a market that the bigger firm wants, then you can negotiate higher than book value.
Right.
At times. But that's kind of the basic thing that you need someone to determine.
Right.
You
know, right.
What is that hard value? And by the way, you know, very few people will, there's this issue of goodwill or reputation of the firm, which does have value, particularly in an internal sale, because those people can really take advantage of that reputation and goodwill. And an external sale as well, you know, if they're looking for a firm that's really entrenched in a certain market and is well seen, well received in that place or niche, you know, that might be that they might include some amount of reputation or some number for goodwill in the book value, but that's a negotiation point, you know.
It's right.
It's intangible, so it has to be talked about.
right. Or a brand, you know, where a firm has actually built a specific brand, not, you know, more than just a reputation, but, you know, a specific brand separate from the owners that, you know, that might also have value, but that too is probably negotiated.
I believe it is. So they kind of start with the hard things that can have value, and then the soft aspects like goodwill, reputation, brand are, really negotiable items, because the question is how much will that value be there when the founder leaves, or
right,
when the big firm takes over the small firm, or,
right,
you know? So
and that's the value of a brand over the name of a firm, you know, firm owner.
Exactly. So does that go away? You know, is that real? So that's a question for negotiation.
Right. Which is, you know, much less often, because there aren't many architects that really work to build a brand like that separate from the ownership.
That's right.
I think we that fabulous information. I think that architects will find a lot of value in our conversation today. I was wondering, you know, maybe the last question is maybe if you had a favorite business book other than the two that you've authored yourself. Is there a specific book, and maybe not even necessarily specifically architecture, but business in general, that you could recommend that architects should read?
Yeah. Well, there's a great book on finance called Financial Management for Design Professionals by Steve Wintner that I would really recommend to any small firm owners. And similarly, there's a book on strategic planning for design professionals by Ray Kogan and Kara Bobchek that is also really an excellent resource when it comes to understanding the strategic planning process. And so those are targeted towards small design firms. And one thing I would say about the handbook is that the 15th edition, just coming out in November, I think after the new year, it's going to be sold by AIA bookstore in chapters electronically.
Oh, interesting. So you download PDFs kind of thing?
Right. So you don't have to buy the entire book, which is fairly expensive.
Some inside information for the entrepreneur architect listeners.
There you go.
That's excellent. How about some contact information for you if listeners wanted to get in touch to say hello or thank you, or just to kind of get some ideas on consulting work? How could they reach you?
Well, first, my website is rmklein, that's K-L-E-I-N, rmklein.com, and there's a contact page there, or you can email me directly at Rena, R-E-N-A, at rmklein.com, or you can give me a call, 206-898-9740.
Excellent. And all of that information will be on my website at entrearchitect.com.
Great.
And we'll put all that on the show notes. So thank you very much, Rena, for your time and for sharing some information with us. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Mark. It has been a pleasure. Appreciate it.
Have a great day.
You too. Thank you. Bye-bye.
I want to thank Rena Klein for joining me here on the Entrepreneur Architect Podcast and for sharing so much valuable information. Be sure to visit entrearchitect.com/episode12 for the show notes and links to all the books that Rena mentioned in the episode. Before I end this today, I want to mention that this episode, episode 12, marks the 1-year anniversary of the Entrepreneur Architect Podcast, as well as the relaunch of entrearchitect.com as a resource for small firm architects. I want to thank each and every one of you for the overwhelming support for what I'm doing here. And I encourage you to get involved on the blog, at the Facebook page, on Twitter, and on LinkedIn. I have an active growing community on every platform, and Entrepreneur Architect in 2014 is going bigger. In 2014, I'm going to launch the podcast on a weekly basis. And I'll be introducing solo episodes where I'll get into more of the subjects that sort of get my heart beating, like family firm integration, the virtual studio, art versus profit, and the psychology of success. So tell a friend, the Entrepreneur Architect Podcast is going weekly. Subscribe on iTunes today. I'll also be producing short educational videos for you in 2014, and I'll be launching Entrepreneur Architect TV, which is going to be Google Hangouts, where I'm going to host a group of architects. We're going to talk business, we're going to talk design, we're going to talk architecture, and anything else that makes us happy. It's going to be a casual, fun thing, so I really think you're going to like that. And the biggest thing I have planned for 2014, Entrepreneur Architect Academy is going to finally be launched. I'm working on the details right now, and I'll be releasing more information soon. If you want to learn more about Entrepreneur Architect Academy, sign up for the pre-launch list. EntreArchitect.com/courses. You'll know anything about Entre Architect Academy before anybody else, and you'll also be offered early bird pricing if you're on that pre-launch list. Everybody on that list is going to be the first one to know anything, and you're going to get early bird pricing. So sign up for that right now, entrearchitect.com/courses, and I'll let you know when things are ready to be released. Don't miss out on this, because this, the Entrepreneur Architect Academy, is something that's going to change your life as a small firm architect, I promise you. So sign up right now, entrearchitect.com/courses. So that's a wrap for episode 12 and for 2013. My name is Mark R. LePage, and I am an entrepreneur architect. I wish you a very happy new year and a prosperous and profitable 2014.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and this sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure. And when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark Arlepage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.